Hello world, I'm Hank Key. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. This is a pre-recorded show, and we are not taking telephone calls this evening. This past week was Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and Cyber Monday, representing the busiest shopping period of the year. Black Friday is the day following Thanksgiving Day in the United States, which is the fourth Thursday of the month. Since 1932, it has been regarded as the beginning of the Christmas shopping season in the United States, and most major retailers open very early and more recently during overnight hours and offer promotional sales. Black Friday is not an official holiday. The term Cyber Monday was created by marketing companies to persuade people to shop online. The term was first used on November 28, 2005. Cyber Monday, however, quickly becoming one of the biggest online shopping day of the year. In 2014, spending volume on Black Friday fell off sharply for the first time since the 2008 recession. The four-day Black Friday weekend was down 11% from the prior year. Christmas creep has been cited as a factor in the diminishing importance of Black Friday, as many retailers now spread out their promotion over the entire months of November and December, rather than concentrate them on a single shopping day or weekend. Then, in 2010, as a counterpart to Black Friday and Cyber Monday, American Express promoted Small Business Saturday, encouraging holiday shoppers to patronize brick-and-mortar businesses that are small and local to the community. To paraphrase an alleged political quote, you never want an undesignated date on the calendar to go to waste. Black Friday sales really cover the period from Thanksgiving Day to Christmas Eve. Traditionally, absurd low prices are made available during that time period. Originally, Black Friday was an in-store event the day after Thanksgiving. Shoppers would line up in front of stores starting at midnight Friday, keeping a dawn vigil for the stores to open. When the store was open for business, there would be a mad dash inside for the deals. The term Black Friday originated in Philadelphia, where it was used to describe the heavy and disruptive pedestrian and car traffic that would occur on the day after Thanksgiving. This usage dates back to at least 1961. More than 20 years later, as the phrase became more widespread, a popular explanation became that this day represented the point in the year when retailers begin to turn a profit, thus going from being in the red to being in the black. 30% of the annual retail sales occur between Black Friday and Christmas. For many years, it was common for retailers to open at 6 a.m. the day after Thanksgiving. But about 10 years ago, many stores crept the opening time to 5 a.m. and then 4 a.m. This was taken to a new extreme in 2011 when several retailers opened at midnight for the first time. In 2012, Walmart and several other retailers announced they would open most of their stores at 8 p.m. on Thanksgiving Day, prompting such stores as JCPenney, Best Buy, and Radio Shack opened at 5 o'clock on Thanksgiving Day, while stores such as Target, Walmart, Sears opened at 6 p.m. on Thanksgiving Day. Three states, however, Rhode Island, Maine, and Massachusetts, prohibit large supermarkets and big box stores as well as department stores from opening on Thanksgiving due to blue laws. I remember back in 2008, a Valley Stream Walmart employee was trampled to death as shoppers rushed in as the door was being opened. However, as Cyber Monday morphed into Black Friday, there is no longer long lines of people waiting to get inside a store, nor do they have to maintain early dawn vigils. But the stores still pack in large crowds. With the advent of the internet, today more than half of Black Friday sales take place online, and many holiday shoppers go online instead of visiting stores. Prospective buyers are still, however, flocking to the malls, but online shopping represents well over half of all Black Friday sales. It appeared that predictions that consumers would pass on Black Friday this year was somewhat exaggerated. Consumers are not only crowding into the stores looking for bargains, stores that open on Thanksgiving and millions more shop online in the comfort of sitting at home instead of being part of the mob at the stores. There are advantages of shopping at the physical store. You can touch and feel the product and not rely on some slick promotional literature. You see the actual size and you have a better sense of the quality and the build of the item. But there is the pressure to make a quick decision before another shopper standing next to you snap up the item. There is also the euphoric ambience of shopping with an enthusiastic crowd. The advantages of online shopping, however, is different. You have the computer to search quickly whether the price is really a bargain or not, and you have a little more time to make the decision to buy or just walk away. If you had not had any physical exposure to the product, you are buying the item in the blind. Some people find the purchase items may look great on paper, but when they actually get into their hands and they can touch it, and not to be as sturdy as it looked. Macy said that there were more than 16,000 shoppers lined up outside its New York flagship store in Herald Square as the doors opened this Thanksgiving. It reported that early sales receipts suggest a lot of people will be finding sweaters and other clothing under the tree this year. Target reported stores were jammed with shoppers on Thanksgiving night, with its biggest single sales day ever. Target said TV sets were among the most popular items, with consumers, you got to get this, with consumers buying more than 3,200 television sets every minute during the first hour that the stores were open. Early indications also point to strong sales of Apple products, including the Apple Watch Series 1. Last year, Cyber Monday, Amazon said that customers ordered more than 54 million items worldwide, which set a record. However, it said that based on early sales data, it expects that sales will shatter last year's record. Did the large number of retailers took a stand against opening on Thanksgiving miss the boat? Nah, probably not. It is reported the Mall of America, which this year remained closed on the holidays, had even bigger crowds lining up for its Black Friday opening than it did last year. The Mall of America is the largest shopping mall in the United States. Not all sales items are at blockbuster prices. Is it the latest or the greatest, or is it some sort of leftover from the past season? Well, a great many of the items were marginally discounted or at regular selling prices. How does one find any of the touted Black Friday specials? A website that I found very informative is DealNews.com. That's DEALNEWS.com. Not all advertised product items are accurately described. Groupon advertised a ThinkPad for $145. The picture of the unit did not have the trademark ThinkPad red track point. The product number stated in the ad matches that for a Lenovo N22 unit. If you think you're buying a ThinkPad, you ain't buying one. There's nothing wrong with buying a discontinued product, however, if it meets all your requirements. But you should not buy it at the manufacturer's suggested list price when it was released as a new product. There are very few rare exceptions to this rule. A vintage used Leica camera will cost more than the price of the camera when new. But more than ever, you have to do your homework and beware of phishing scams. If the offering is from a source that is not familiar, do not click on the offer. Even then, you have to be on the alert if the URL looks authentic, and don't be confused by the familiar-looking link within an authentic site. Demonstrating how easy it is for hackers to register counterfeit domain names in an attempt to fish for personal data, a Russian scammer, Vitaly Popov, tweaked the Google.com URL ever so slightly. In other words, to you, the average consumer, it just looked like Google.com. In this case, the leading G is not your traditional capital letter, but instead a Latin letter, small capital G, with a character code value of 0262. If possible, manually retype the URL, and you can expect to see many more variations to URL manipulation now that this is out. There are many refurb electronics offering. Our preference is to buy direct from the manufacturer. If you want to purchase a refurb item from a retailer, deal with a known, reliable vendor that offers a return policy. Read the reviews from multiple sources. Check with the manufacturer website for product specification, and don't rely on the advertised print. If you miss a fantastic offer, no big deal, no problem, as there will always be another one. There is an urge to buy when an item is priced at a ridiculously low price and it's almost too good to be true. We tend to buy it whether or not it's really needed. Have you checked your drawers and closets for items that are still packed and unopened? Consumer electronics is expected to account for more than half of all sales this year. In politics, it's called polling to determine what the likely results will be prior to the election process. In consumer marketing, they call it running surveys to determine what the consumer is most likely to buy. For this holiday season, the prediction was 4K television sets would be the top-selling item. Usually, these studies are pretty accurate, but not this year. As we know, the political posters this year missed, and the marketing survey consultants have also missed this year. The top-selling item for this holiday is not the television sets, but wireless headphones. On recent shows, I had given a heads up that Dell would be offering an 11-inch Inspiron notebook for under $100. Now that is a real bargain. Lenovo on Black Friday sold their IdeaPad model 100S, which is similarly configured to the Dell for also under $100. In each case, under $100 meant, $99.99. In the case of Dell, there were limited quantities. For Lenovo, it was limited to the one day, which was Black Friday. If I had missed the Dell deal, I would have opted for the Lenovo Model 100S. The Dell unit with a Celeron CPU is about a third faster than the Atom CPU in the Lenovo unit. If you miss the deals, don't worry. There's always another deal around the corner. I did look for the rumored Chromebook selling for $100. I didn't find any. If it had been available, I would have still purchased the Windows Notebook because available applications top having a product that is cool. Low-cost or budget Windows Notebooks regularly sell for around $200 and up. During this Black Friday period, many Windows Notebooks are priced from $150 to $200. This Inspiron unit is reasonably configured. It has the Celeron CPU instead of the Atom processor. The flash memory card storage is 32 gigabytes versus 16 gigabytes. It is equipped with Bluetooth, USB 3.0, USB 2.0, SD card reader, HDMI, and Wi-Fi. This unit regularly sells for $200 on the Dell website, and there were three colors, red, white, and blue, but it was only the white that was available, and the blue is at a higher cost. I couldn't resist. I went online at the prescribed time of 6 p.m. Eastern Time. I was able to order one unit. That was the limit. And it was only in white. Apparently, red sells well and it was not on sale. The blue unit costing $30 more was probably the next preferred color. The white unit sold out in 16 minutes according to Dell logs. The blue model sold out in 91 minutes. Did I need another unit? I guess I didn't heed my own advice to buy what you need and not buy just because it was a fantastic deal. Like most Americans, I can easily do the self-justification. The unit itself is a very usable configuration. I could add a 64 gigabyte or more flash memory card if needed for more storage. And of course, I can go even higher than that. However, I do have spare 32 gigabyte flash memory cards and I can use that in the present time. I can buy USB dongle Ethernet adapter if I want to hardwire the unit for online transaction. I expect to use the unit for online web activity, and I probably will install Kingsoft Office Free for casual office functions. Kingsoft Office Free is a near function and operation equivalent of Microsoft Office for home students. I would not have to be overly cautious about malware and ransomware, as I would just merely do a factory reset if the unit got hacked. From time to time, I do have house guests asking if they can access my computer to check on some information, such as whether or not the scheduled air flight is on time. Now, I do not need to be overly concerned, as any personal data would not be on that system. I just may make it a Christmas gift for a grandchild. Let me scratch that. The problem, however, is if I give the one, the others will feel slighted. I guess I'll just keep it for myself to run Linux distros. For the reason I just gave for the purchase of the notebook, there are probably many home consumers that only need a computer to be on the internet and have light office functions. But with a budget notebook, which what seems to be limited storage, what can you install to keep the cost down? I had mentioned Kingsoft Office Free. It consists of three modules: Writer for word processing, Presentation for the equivalent of PowerPoint presentation and preparation, and Spreadsheet, which is the equivalent of Excel. It requires 82 megabytes of storage compared to Microsoft Office needing 512 megabytes, which, however, contains many more of the other functions, includes Outlook and other modules similarly included. Kingsoft Office is available for Windows, Mac OS X, Linux, iOS, and Android system. There are other Office alternatives. There's OpenOffice and LibreOffice. Unlike Microsoft Office, OpenOffice and LibreOffice are functions applied to the document, whereas in Microsoft, the apps each have its own document. For those who use Microsoft Office at work, these two alternatives make overall navigation cumbersome and not for efficient usage. This is like someone who works in Hong Kong driving on the left side of the road and going home back onto the mainland driving on the right side of the road. Microsoft has been building more and more functions into Microsoft Office, yet many of us use only a fraction of all the features. If you really need all the functions of Microsoft Office in a budget notebook, there's Office 365, which uses cloud services. It is software as a service. It is not a purchase item. It is a leased item. There is an annual fee for this usage. With all these electronic devices available today, we have a lot of wireless devices, wire devices, and it does not make for a good decor, and it does create a problem in the home. So I asked Marty Winston to offer his insight on this.
Let's talk about wires and wives. Now, that's a politically incorrect term. I believe what they prefer to say now is the spousal approval factor. And this is going to impact you more times than you think, including any time you're dealing with home automation, any time you're dealing with alarm systems, many times when you're dealing with chargers, and of course, home theater, if there is such a thing anymore, or stereo systems, anywhere where you're running wires from one thing to another, anywhere you're adding blocks in plugs or boxes on the floor. As soon as your spouse, significant other, says, "Get that ugly thing out of my living room," you'll know what spousal approval is all about. Let's go back to its roots. And we speak about high fidelity. There was an era when it was called that. It was the 50s. It was the 60s. It was a time when we first had the tuner and the separate record changer and the separate amplifier and maybe a separate preamp and a separate equalizer and all of these separate boxes that all had to be cabled together. And that was fine because all of those cables tended to get hidden behind the boxes or run behind a bookshelf or wherever you put them. But then there were speakers and stereo 2.0 sound. Stereo was challenge enough. Your box was almost never right next to that stuff. Where it was in a bookshelf system, you didn't get many complaints. The compact desktop systems, not many complaints. Some people built, Arvin was one of all people. Some people built little stereo separates or combined stereo units with a receiver and a couple of speakers in a case. Didn't sound wonderful, but it was stereo. You could hear the separation. In fact, early on, stereo required at least FM's, well, I'm sorry, initially stereo was one channel on AM and one on FM. Then came FM stereo using a technique called multiplexing, where initially you had to buy a separate multiplex adapter. I think I got mine for $19 at Olsen Radio, something of the sort. And that way, one station could really feed both channels. Amazing. Not so many wires there, but the speakers. As soon as the speakers left the tabletop, as soon as they left the bookshelf, they had to go on the floor. And when the speaker went on the floor, the wiring to reach the speaker went on the floor. And the wiring for the speaker, if you were smart, got tucked between the carpet and the base plate of the trim on the wall. You would hide it. If you could hide the wiring, you might get away with it. But you might still have that significant other say, "Get that box out of here. I don't want that box in here. It's ugly. Get it out of here." No matter how much you polished the wood, no matter how much extra you paid for veneer, any of that, get it out of here. It's not furniture. And that helped soften the market impact of the high fidelity era. It really did. And then came surround sound. Okay, now you need two channels in front of you, a subwoofer, a center channel, and two rear channels. But that's only 5-1. What if you were 7-2 or 9-2 or any of the other schemes? You're putting speakers in places where you cannot possibly do anything without wires running in the visual space. The visual space is the key to spousal disapproval. As soon as that wire is there, you're in trouble. So the home theater era hinged on the people who are now in CEDIA, the consumer, I don't even remember what it's, CEDIA. These are the installers who would come in and install the home theater system. And they would add the controllers and the remote controls and sell you the things that look like theater seats and the curtain controls and the motorized screen, whatever worked for that particular installation. This got integrated and installed by the CEDIA people. They were very good at that. They got into a lot of trouble not many years ago, but they got through it. Now, the CEDIA experience, hide those ugly wires, also extended past the surround sound era, past the ersatz theater in the home era, home theater. Well, let's all have a fantasy, shall we? And really started having a bit of a dip when home theater disappeared as a phenomenon the people wanted in their homes. Had to happen, it happened. So what did they do? Well, they got into whole house remote control systems, and, you know, that's fine. That's still an upscale customer. But they also got into home automation, because home automation should require some wiring, doesn't always, and even if you have wireless systems, there's this whole integration controller and panel on the wall stuff that tends to happen. So they got involved again, just mostly, and I've asked these guys, mostly because if the guy doesn't hide the wires, he doesn't get his toys to play with. And I'm sorry to characterize it that way, it's politically incorrect, but it's accurate. Now, let's back up again, a little bit of history, and this is well in. There was an early home automation era, an X10 era. That was a standard by which signals could get superimposed on the power line and go between units. It was an aficionado thing. If you weren't really into it, you didn't bother with it. You know, you hook up your TRS-80 to turn the lights on and off. It's that era. There was also a panacea to install your own home security system. You know, ADT was burgeoning, and you could see they had all these little things on the windows and on the doors and glass break and auto dialers and woo-woo-woo sirens and all that, and guys thought, hey, I can do that. And they started wiring glass break detectors, which were often foil or little microphones, or they would wire these magnetic or mechanical open window, open door signals and all of that, and they ended up running wires between those things. So did the ADT guys. But the ADT guys hid it down under the carpet and in the trim. Not so much so for the do-it-yourselfers. So once again, get those ugly wires out of my living room was a factor that controlled the marketplace. Now, I bring that up because we're dealing today with almost exactly the same thing in home automation. But the consequences in home automation are something that most people just aren't aware of or ignore. One is that wireless was chosen because with wireless, you put a battery in the thing and the guy buys it and brings it home before he realizes that there's an end of life to the battery. Not that he can't change the battery. I'll get into that in a second. Now, you've got either something with a battery in it that you've stuck somewhere, or you've got a cube plugged into a wall or a wall wart or that kind of thing. And the next thing you know, you've got these little white blobs all over the place doing kind of the same thing that the security systems did and doing kind of the same thing that the remote control systems did. But you've got, you may not have wires so much. But what you do have is every outlet tends to be occupied. Little white blobs get stuck in strange places. And the spousal approval term for that, everybody paying attention, it's called wall measles. little white bumps everywhere in the house, wall measles, and spousal approval factor does kick in. You should hear the stories from the enthusiasts. The spouse will say, "Why don't you just get up off your butt, stand up, and turn the light switch off yourself? Why do you have to do it through a smartphone?" That's not dumb. That's a pretty smart comment. The bad part about batteries is that people are terrible at babysitting them. So let's say you've got this really cool installation of your home, of lots and lots of off-the-shelf home automation, best-of-breed stuff. Now, jump in the TARDIS time machine, jump ahead 3 years, come back out and check out the system. You know what you're going to find? Something's not working quite right. Do you know what's not working quite right? Well, you might have a system with hundreds of places with batteries. And some of those batteries might well be weak or dead. And when they die, how does anybody know? They're not going to go through 100 things and figure out which battery is dead. They're not experienced enough or analytical enough to do a diagnostic and figure out, okay, if this isn't working, then that means this input is not up or that output is not happening. We need to adjust this sensor or you're not even going to remember where all the little blobs are. So a caution, if you will, if you're looking at home automation, try to stay away from batteries. If you can't, think twice, three times about exactly what you want to do.
In the past 20 years, almost everything in the analog world has moved to the digital world. But many are discovering that the analog world has advantages over the digital world. You might say, what's old is new again. Last year, vinyl record sales hit over $400 million, the highest since 1988. There are two big surprises about who's doing the buying. First, 72% are people younger than age 36. That was a surprise. And second, almost half the people buying records don't even listen to them. For that group, they are record collectors, and it's a fashion statement, and it's a hip thing to do. There are lots of theories about why vinyl records appeal to millennials. In 2015, Billboard homed in on three: the desire to focus on the music instead of something that plays in the background, a craving to collect that something's tangible, and the perception that the music sounds better on vinyl. Artists liked also the 12-inch records because they're a great way to package albums, featuring full-scale art and allowing inserts such as posters, CDs, and the download cards. Records can be many things for their fans. Hipster fashion accessory, better listening experience, art and photography canvas. For collectors, they're a rich reminder of why music matters. It's a big mistake thinking that the digital world was going to liberate us from all the burden of physical objects. People forgot that the super cool product, the artwork, the love that went into creating these works are a big part of the joy. A short break for public service announcements. The Westchester PC User Group will be meeting December 1st, this Thursday, at 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor in White Plains. The Icon PC User Group will be having a presentation, Fabulous Freeware, software that is, well, it's beggarware, but it's free. Friday, December 2nd, 6:45 p.m. at the Brentwood Public Library. It's located at 2nd Avenue and 4th Street at Brentwood, Long Island. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be meeting Friday also, December 2nd, at 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on cable TV cord cutting on Tuesday, December the 6th, at 7:30 p.m., and the presentation will be held at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing Community Room, they will be meeting on Tuesday, December the 6th at 2 p.m., and the presentation is the Mobile Digital Revolution, and they're located at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will be meeting Thursday, December 8th at 7 p.m., and the presentation is Thoroughly Modern MIDI. It's a presentation on MIDI music at NYU 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 414. The Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, December the 13th at 7:15 p.m. at the Rassel Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Moor at West Nyack, New York. To get your group's events mentioned on the show, send us an email at pcradio@gmail.com and give us the name of your computer organization, topic of presentation, date and time of the meeting, its venue, and room number if it's applicable. I have an open message to the webmasters who maintain the websites for the respective computer clubs. Place your meeting notice in one place, preferably on the home page with the information that I so noted. A site that is updated once a day or at least two or three times a week is considered a frequently updated site by Google. The Google bot that crawls the web is constantly searching for web pages that are new or updated and then adds the fresh content to the Google index. If you update your content often with reliable and valuable information, then you have a better chance of Google ranking your site higher with each update. The more frequently you update your website with articles, downloads, and new web pages, the more frequently your search engine will stop by to visit your website. When search engines look at your site more frequently, you have the opportunity to achieve higher ranking based on the content you provide. Search engines use web crawlers, robot bots, or Google bots, which are simply high-tech programs that can scan the internet for websites. The web crawler indexes a website based on an algorithm determined by the search engine company. For instance, a site may be indexed based upon a combination of number of incoming links to the site, the number of type of subject and keywords used, how often the site is updated, every time you make an update to your website. Thus, if you want to increase the chances of your website getting a higher ranking, update the content frequently so that a search engine will reassess your position on its index. Keep in mind, more content is not the key here. Quality is. So yes, it is a good idea to update frequently, but keep your content standards high. If you blast your page with a ton of low-quality articles stuffed with keywords, you're going to be penalized. By far, the most frequently used search engine is Google, and as a king of all search engines, Google has a tremendous influence on webmasters on how websites are constructed and designed. When Google expresses its love for websites that updates frequently, this is a sure sign that you should add fresh material to your website as often as you can. Of course, you should not make unnecessary changes, additions, or posting every hour of every day. However, a site that is updated once a day or at least two or three times a week is considered a frequently updated site. Keep your meeting announcements on the home page, as this will minimize the navigation for anyone that may be interested in attending a meeting. Have you thought about what stocking stuffers or knickknacks for gift giving that you might want to buy for friends or family and so on? Let me make a couple of suggestions. USB flash drives, that's easy, just about everyone uses it. A power bank battery charger. If your smartphone or your tablet runs out of power, these units can give you the temporary boost so that you can continue to use it. However, if you do buy these, look for 2600 milliamp support. You have a lot of cheap ones out there that does not give you that rating in capacitance. So look for 2600 milliamps. The other item that you could also buy that's just about universal for everyone is SD or micro SD flash memory cards. I see a lot of people poking the smartphone or the tablet with their fingers. You could think about buying them a tablet stylus. You could also buy a US flash memory card reader for those who constantly attaching the camera to the computer to move information across. The card reader would simplify the process. And for people who have recently purchased or are in the process of buying a low-end PC, one of the things that you might want to get for them is a USB 2.0 to fast internet adapter. They cost anywhere from $10 to $15. It's a very low-cost item. And this would enable them to go onto the internet to do live banking transactions and not go through Wi-Fi, which is less secure. a wireless mouse is, or something that you might want to give, and for people who find that the finger collide is a little awkward. Some units are not equipped with Bluetooth, and you could buy a Bluetooth USB adapter. Get the Bluetooth 4.0 USB adapter. I find that in the marketplace there are three types of USB Bluetooth adapters, version 2, 4, and 5. 5 is new, you don't know whether or not they're backward compatible. 4 is predominantly what most products are, and if it's 2, that's too old, you don't want that. As always, if you're listening to the Personal Computer Show, and someone may have access to the internet but not to a computer, you might want to buy them an internet radio receiver, and they cost anywhere from $70 to $200. And one item I happen to like, which I've been recommending a number of people, is a little tiny portable speaker from Sprott. It's a Bluetooth portable speaker, and it can double as a conference phone. And the whole unit is under $70, and that's a good buy. For those who live in metropolitan areas like New York City, the summertime is a constant reminder that we have brownouts. I recommend the purchase of a UPS or an uninterruptible power supply. Today, they're relatively small. They're not expensive at all. You can buy a UPS unit, which is maybe bigger than a cigar box, and it will have at least 8 to 10 minutes of runtime until the power is exhausted. It will take the place of the surge protector that you're using today. For most people, when the surge protector goes, they're not even aware that it's blown. It's a good voltage regulator. And for $40 and up, these are worthwhile investments. Had you thought about buying a speaker system to give that flat panel TV a better sound? Did you had to go through to sort out the facts, the figures, and specs to determine which Bluetooth speaker would best meet your needs? The majority of Bluetooth speakers are portable because they get paired with mobile phones, but more and more manufacturers are introducing models designed to remain inside the home. Choosing a portable model gives you the best of both worlds in some respects, but a stationary speaker is more apt to blend into your home's decor and is most likely to produce the sound you're looking for if fidelity is priority one in your book. And these are some of the features you want to evaluate in a Bluetooth speaker. Pairing a smartphone to a Bluetooth may enable you to create customized equalization curves for different styles of music, create wake-up alarms, or power the speaker on and off remotely. Look for one of those features. Next to fidelity, a portable speaker's most important feature is how long can it operate when it's not plugged into the wall. You should expect a battery to last about 10 to 20 hours, but remember that the bigger the battery, the heavier the speaker will be. And then, with a portable speaker, you have charging options. It will need to be charged for use. Speakers that charge their batteries via a USB port are more convenient than models that require an AC adapter, but larger batteries might not offer that option. Some speakers also let you plug in a USB cable to tap your battery to charge your smartphone. Some Bluetooth speakers have built-in microphones that enable you to use the speaker as a speakerphone in concert with your smartphone. The sound quality will be much better than what you'll get from your telephone, and you'll be able to turn the volume up and down, and this can be very handy for conference calls. Some speakers let you create a left-right stereo pair with two speakers. This works best, however, when two speakers are identical. Portable Bluetooth speakers can be used indoors and outdoors, so the best models provide some protection from the elements. Ideally, the manufacturer will let you know just how much protection you can expect by providing an IP marking or an international protection marking. Higher-priced Bluetooth speakers also provide the option of connecting to your Wi-Fi network so that you can stream music and other programs. Wi-Fi streams will offer higher fidelity than Bluetooth. A speaker that provides for a hardwired network connection is all the more versatile. A Bluetooth speaker's range depends on the power class of its radio, and it can vary widely and is impacted by the environment that it's operating in. A Class 1 radio offers range of approximately 100 meters. That works out to about 300 feet. But the number of walls between Bluetooth source and the speaker and the type of materials in those walls will have a significant impact on the range. It's much easier for radio waves to pass through dry walls than masonry walls. Objects in the signal path, such as large metal appliances, will also reduce that range even further. with all this modern electronics, we don't seem to be striving for authenticity of sound. What's happened to high fidelity? So I asked Marty Winston to offer his insight on this.
One of the things Hank asked me to talk about is high fidelity, which used to mean exactly those words back in the 50s and the 60s when it was first a fad. Try to remember that before that, and for a lot of you I know this is museum stuff, before that, speakers were small, and I mean, not always small. They would range from roughly 3 to roughly 12 inches. But they were not about doing anything other than reproducing the sound. Oh, how amazing! We could hear somebody from thousands of miles away. The magic of radio or the phonograph and all of this wonderful technology. But then people started saying, hey, I want to listen to records and I want them to sound better. Records are those vinyl hard disks we used to use that mechanically activated signals that became music, or talk, or other stuff back then. Anyway, high fidelity arose when people decided, okay, if we use a better speaker, and if we pay attention to the box that's in, and if we use the right kind of amplifiers, and then add equalizers and other pieces of hardware that help all of that work, then we might listen to something that sounds a lot closer to what was actually the sound in the studio when the recording was being made. That's a term that today we call acoustic transparency. It means that the entire recording and playback process is inaudible. It makes no change in coloration, makes no change in emphasis. It's your ears in place back when the recording was made. That's acoustic transparency. It means exactly the same thing as high fidelity. Fidelity, a Latin term that means, of all things, truth. Truth, transparency, clearness of purpose. Now, in the old days, there were brands we all adored. There was a Macintosh that didn't have an A in it. MC, Macintosh, which was, oh my gosh, if you could ever have a Macintosh amplifier, life could end happily. It was the best, clearest sound. Slightly warm, vacuum tube, so that little bit of kind of sizzle in the sound. But you loved listening to that Macintosh to the extent that you could. Speakers grew from little boxes on the desktop to giant boxes in the living room to clusters of boxes, and there were variations. Klipsch, K-L-I-P-S-C-H, became known for a particular kind of horn driver. By horn, I mean it's got a chamber like the end of a euphonium or a trombone in some cases, but bigger than that, more like a tuba. That horn drove the sound out. The horn allowed for a different kind of listening experience, and so the Klipsch horn had its fans. Bose was a brand back then. Bozak was out there. There were many brands, some of which are still here today, but not quite what they were. Acoustic Research, the AR speakers, were very well received, especially their, I'll say smaller, their bookshelf-sized speakers, still the size of a bread box. And one of the brands you know today, Bose, had much better sound back then than they do now. Anyone who thinks that Bose, this is my opinion now, anyone who thinks that Bose is great-sounding audio does not have a good ear for audio. Bose reaches the masses by tailoring the response curve to make people think they're hearing a full big sound, but when in fact what they're hearing is a tailored sound, a make the masses happy kind of sound. There are many other definitive technology as an example of a current speaker company that does a wonderful job of making, in every size speaker they make, of making that acoustic transparency happen. Some of the Polk products are good for that, and there are others, but the point is, nobody today cares very much. We're dealing with people, including you maybe, people who grew up with earbuds. An earbud cannot, laws of physics, cannot give you good fidelity. It can give you a good representation of what the music might sound like. It will always compromise the lows. It will always do something a little weird with the highs. The mid-range may or may not be okay, depending on the tricks they've done to accomplish those other two. And all of that aside, the quality of the sound you hear with earbuds depends on how you place it in your ear. So let's forget the names and forget the practice and get back into a little bit of the theory and then what you can do about it. In order to sound more like the studio, you want to be dealing with something where you can tell the difference. Acoustic instruments, you know, things that they played in band in school, guitars, even amplified guitars are fine. Acoustic instruments have a sound. They have amplifiers on them. They still have a sound. And you've seen the sound because you've seen live performances. You know what to expect. How do you hear that when you're listening? I'm going to tell you the very best thing you can do to get started in understanding the difference between tailored sound, which is colored, which is really compromised and distorted, versus acoustic transparency, true high fidelity, is to go to a store that sells many, many kinds of headphones and try a variety of headphones on the kind of content you listen to, but also, old trick, listen to something symphonic. The frequency range, the span of highs to lows, and the loudness range of symphony performances exceeds what you'll find in almost any other kind of representational music. Is there an FM tuner there? Is there another audio source? Find something symphonic. Play it through the headphones. Don't just listen to one. Listen to at least four and hopefully six to eight. Something will sound to you suddenly as if you're in the experience, not just in the headphones. You've just experienced. You do that, you will have just experienced what true fidelity means, what acoustic transparency can be. Now, I've spent a lot of my life in recording studios, doing different things, including music, including commercials and other things. I can tell you that seeking a wonderfully acoustic transparent speaker system is an exercise in getting yet another mortgage. That stuff is very expensive. Every time you take speakers home, you are going to compromise because your room is not acoustically as good as the theater. Those speakers are unlikely to be as expensive as the ones in the theater, and then you've got to drive them with something. So what are you going to drive them with? If you're listening to MP3 recordings, and I can tell you, you're hearing me on at least MP3 and maybe worse. If you're listening to MP3 recordings, you already have a small compromise in there. Not many ears on the planet can hear the difference, but there are some. You may have some. If you are listening to good quality recordings, especially digital, at least CD quality recordings, then you may be able to pick up on the detail. If you're listening to a combo with a guitar in it, listen for the finger moving along the fret. That's the kind of detail that makes a difference. If you're listening to violins, listen for the bow on the string. That detail will tell you that things are happening. If you're listening to a classic, you know, a Dean Martin, a Frank Sinatra, listen for every instrument in the orchestra. Levels of detail are why people who enjoy high fidelity really get a kick out of it. It is different. It's a different kind of experience. And it's one that I think you too will enjoy. But don't get crazy. Every fad is a fad. Every whim is a whim. And the desire to hear better may or may not be important to your life. If you really want to hear better, but occasional is okay, go to a live performance. That's just fine. If you want to hear better all the time, do small upgrades. For example, if you go to Timo Labs, they have a small box that goes on a tabletop or desktop piece of furniture that can somewhat enhance the sound you hear out of that TV set on the wall. Worth chasing down. If you go to Audio Technica, they have a high end, a low end, a pro end. Somewhere in the high to pro end, you'll find headphones that are better than what you've usually listened to. I'm not suggesting you go online right now and buy everything I mentioned, but I am suggesting there's another world out there that sounds more like the real world out there.
As a final segment for today, I will be talking about replacing a hard disk drive or installing or replacing a solid-state drive. Had you thought about hard disk drive replacement? You need to replace your hard drive because of failure or a need to have greater capacity? Is one more brand reliable than the next? Well, for the past 3 years, online backup provider Backblaze has been testing the reliability of hard disk drives it uses to store its customers' data. They have installed 62,000 drives running in its service, and sometimes they're going to fail. And when they do, Backblaze, you know, takes note, letting the world know which ones have caused the most problems. Backblaze found that HGST drives proved to be most reliable, regardless of size or brand or drives, while Western Digital and Seagate duke it out for the dubious honor of having the most failed drives. This year, though, things are quite different. For the first quarter of 2016, the backup provider found that of the 35,000-plus Seagate drives that it operates, slightly more than 200 failed, or around 3.5%. That's a huge drop-off from the prior year of 11% failure. And the biggest difference was that they were using the Seagate's newer 4-terabyte drives, and that has increased reliability. Unfortunately, for Western Digital, though, the same cannot be said for the latest crop of hard disk drives. Of the 1,700 in operation at Backblaze, they had a failure rate of 6.55%. However, none of these results should suggest that the drives in use are poor quality or proved to be failures, as they are subjected to operation of a data center with intensive usage far beyond what you could expect in an average consumer environment. The heat, the vibrations, and other stress factors that must be considered with any such testing should mean that these results be only minor considerations when making your own purchases, but they do give us a large sampling to work with. Even though HGST is the most reliable drive by its own testing metrics, it still employs more Seagate drives, which is surprisingly considering that some of them were unreliable as Seagate drives. Well, how about solid-state drives reliability in the real world? Solid-state drive reliability in the real world, as in the Google experience, they have a very large number of drives in their data centers. And they just released a new paper offering the production life cycle of these solid-state drives. Big surprise! Solid-state drives fail in a different way. And these are some of the conclusions they came up with. Solid-state drives age, not usage, affects reliability. Bad blocks in new solid-state drives are common, and drives with a large number of bad blocks are much more likely to lose hundreds more of other blocks, most likely due to die or chip failure. 30-80% of solid-state drives develop at least one bad block, and 2-7% develop at least one bad chip in the first 4 years of deployment. The paper's conclusion was that age, not use, correlates with the increasing error rates. It means that owner provisioning for fear of flash wear out is not needed, because we've always told that a big factor in solid-state drives is there's a limited number of writes. That's not a real factor. None of the drives in the study came anywhere near their write limits, but it isn't all good news. The solid-state drive is less likely to fail during its normal life, but it's more likely to lose data. And with time running out, that's a wrap for the week. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York. We will be on live next week, and we will be taking telephone calls. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, backup, backup, and backup. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Until we meet again, same station, same time, next week. Happy computing and good night.